I led the effort for Undersecretary LaPlante to scale up production of all the weapon systems we were sending to Ukraine. I live this every day, and we cannot surge production. We cannot. We do not have the capability to do that at the prime level or the sub-tier suppliers.
All players, low down, active, bullseye 1-3-2-7, for tactical.
Welcome to The Merge, where we make sense of defense in an enjoyable way. I'm back with Jake. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you, Mike. Always a good time.
Today's episode is something that I personally have been looking forward to for many, many months. And we were actually going to do this episode about 3 months ago, I think. And we decided to wait. And we were waiting for something to happen. A lot of things have been in the works, but not happening. It's happened. We have people here to talk about it. We have things to talk about. We have strongly held opinions, maybe some spicy takes. We'll see. But we're going to talk about the National Defense Industrial Strategy and the Defense Industrial Base. And to do that, our expert today, we have Chris McKenzie. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And when I said expert, I'm not kidding. She specializes in supply chain strategy, policy, and technology. You worked in the Pentagon in the office that did the industrial base policy. Is that right?
I did. I was the chief technology officer there.
Okay. So this is the best of both worlds. She worked inside of the building in the office that was running this, but she no longer works there. So she is cleared hot to throw all the spears that she wants. So this is great. All right. So the National Defense Industrial Strategy, there's a lot to unpack there. It's a pretty long document, pretty wave top. You could argue it's not really a strategy. Maybe it's a plan, maybe not. But let's start at the very beginning. First of all, Chris, do you have any fill-ins for the rest of your background that we should know before we dive in?
Like I said, I was the chief technology officer for the office. I worked there for 8 years. So, you know, had a lot of experience with supply chains in all the sectors. So we've done a lot of work in this area, worked directly for the undersecretary as well as is their chief technology officer too.
But I'm just going to take this interview sideways. So do you go around and like following parts through supply chains and seeing like how far back they go, or, you know, it's a, like a mom and pop shop somewhere and, you know, building this one washer that, you know, keeps the nuclear warhead together. How do you like trace the supply chains?
Yeah, it's actually very difficult because the Department of Defense has hundreds of thousands of suppliers. In the Industrial Base Policy Office, we were kind of unique, or they're still kind of unique in that in the services, they track things by program. So, you know, there's a program office for the F-35, for, you know, a particular missile system. Each program or system has an office or a program manager. In the Office of Industrial Base Policy, things are tracked by sector. So there is a sector lead for missiles and munitions, which I actually, that's where I started in industrial base policy. I'm a missiles and munitions expert. There's shipbuilding, aircraft, ground vehicles, microelectronics. So they're tracked by sector, and that allows that office to really see a holistic view across that sector, not just one particular program. And that's important because, the services only get to see kind of their particular slice of the pie, right? They only get to see the suppliers that are in that one particular program. But a lot of the issues in the industrial base cross across multiple programs. And if you don't understand that interconnectivity, sometimes you miss the bigger picture issues. So it really affords OSD that kind of broader picture view to see where those cross-cutting issues lie, and allows them to make some of the mitigations and some of the investments that are really across service or really DoD as a whole investments instead of just one particular program.
That's very insightful. I'm thinking at the, you know, you take all the different capabilities divided up in the sectors and you have people in charge of them. How, when you were there, how many people worked in your office?
Well, that's been a chronic issue in that office. Is there's it's been chronically understaffed. There's actually a GAO report that talks about the fact that the office is very understaffed to do this mission. There's usually only one government person to cover a sector or even multiple sectors. And, you know, again, with tens or even hundreds of thousands of suppliers, it's nearly impossible. So, you cannot do a completely extremely detailed look into the supply chain. So usually you're just looking at problem areas. For instance, in missiles and munitions, solid rocket motors was, kind of a chronic problem area. So I spent a lot of time looking at solid rocket motors and maybe didn't spend so much time on some of the other areas that weren't such a big issue. So it is a problem. There's just not enough people to tackle all the problems in the industrial base.
I think all three of us have been in the Pentagon, whether visiting, worked there over, many, many times over many, many years. One of the interesting paradigms that I've always just fascinated me when I'm walking around the Pentagon, I go in the Pentagon, I leave the Pentagon, there's people everywhere, lots of people.
25,000.
But every office I go to somehow is like min-manned, understaffed, and it's just one of those like weird things, life's mysteries. Where do all the people go?
I know. And Congress constantly, pings OSD, especially the Fourth Estate, as being overstaffed. So it's a chronic, constant battle.
As CTO of the office, was your role, are you looking for new technologies that are impacting the industrial base? So would you be looking for, say, a new technology that helps refine a rare earth that we aren't refining domestically today, right? Is that the kind of stuff you are doing, or what was your day-to-day?
Part of my job was to bridge the gap between newer technologies and, existing manufacturing. So I did work closely with the research and engineering part of OSD. I was in the acquisition and sustainment part of OSD to understand some of the newer technologies that were coming aboard. Also things like, hypersonics, for instance. Hypersonics was led by the R&E part of OSD as it was being developed, but we knew it was going to be fielded soon. And so we were paying close attention to what was going on, making sure that the industrial base was going to be ready and being scaled up at the same time that the development was happening so that we could actually field these systems when the technology was ready. So I would, look at those kinds of things, but also advanced manufacturing techniques for things like critical chemicals, where a lot of that manufacturing has gone overseas, especially to adversarial countries. So we need to figure out a way to make our industry more cost competitive so that we can bring some of that capability back to the United States. And we can only do that if it's cost competitive, because that's what drove it offshore in the first place. So looking at new manufacturing techniques that might help us with that area. So yes, new technologies and tracking new capability that was coming online where we needed industrial base capability to match up with that.
For someone who's never heard of the defense industrial base, how would you explain it in like a tweet summary?
Yeah, so, just to be really simplistic about it, it's kind of the people, places, and things that all come together to give the warfighter the equipment that they need to protect our national security. So, it's skills, facilities, processes, technologies, all the things. It can be made up of commercial industry. We use a lot of commercial technology in the Department of Defense. We buy things that just are commercial off the shelf. There's also a lot of things that are so-called dual use. For instance, Boeing makes aircraft for the commercial industry, but they also make military aircraft. But there are also things that are DoD unique. So we have DoD unique suppliers. A perfect example of that would be a warhead used on a missile. Luckily, there's no commercial market for those. So we have DoD unique suppliers as well.
I feel like the term defense industrial base is like just the modern rebranding of the military industrial complex, which I think got a bad rap from Eisenhower's farewell speech.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same thing. I think he just was trying to illustrate that we needed to You know, not let it become its own giant machine, right? That government and industry need to work together. It needs to be a partnership, you know, which is the way that industry and DoD work currently. So that was his fear.
Fair enough. So one of the reasons we delayed this episode was to wait for this new strategy to come out. And it's out, the 2023 National Defense Industrial Strategy, the NDIS. It's the first one ever. I mean, you think about it. It's been, you know, World War II. You go back, whatever, math in public. So 80 years, basically. We haven't had a industrial strategy this whole time in 80 years, not through the Cold War, not through the 90s drawdown. And I guess the place to start is like, what happened? Why didn't we have one?
I would say, you know, although there's never been a document that was officially titled the National Defense Industrial Strategy, the department has published other documents that have essentially done what the strategy has done here, identified the risks and issues that are in the defense industrial base, made recommendations for mitigating those. An example would be in more recent times, not back as far as World War II, but in 2018, there was an executive order 13806, and I was in industrial based policy at the time, and we wrote a report in response to that executive order, and it has a very long title, but it was basically a strategy to, you know, ensure the resilience of the industrial base and the defense industrial base supply chain. And it was a very comprehensive whole of government effort. It had recommendations. It had an implementation plan. So, you know, very similar to what the NDIS is all about. And then there was another one just as recently as 2022, an executive order 14017, securing defense critical supply chains, which was written again by the Industrial Base Policy Office. So there have been numerous reports written. DoD has been using those reports to develop industrial-based strategies and roadmaps to mitigate the most urgent constraints and shortfalls, such as foreign dependency, single and sole source suppliers. You know, however, if you've not read any of those previous documents, and if you're not like immersed in this topic, the NDIS does provide a singular place to find this information, which is extremely useful.
If you look at those prior reports and their recommendations, have they done anything? Have they helped to address the problem?
So within the Department of Defense, I would say yes. You know, it has really shaped, for instance, the Industrial Base Policy Office has the Defense Production Act Title III Investment Program and the Industrial Base Analysis and Sustainment Investment Program. And those programs have roadmaps that are specifically aligned to the recommendations and the structure that was laid out in those executive order reports. And the investments that are being made are specifically tailored to what was identified in those reports as the recommendations. So I would say with regards to, you know, industrial-based investments, yes. Specifically, Executive Order 13806 was done in conjunction with a lot of the interagency, and we could talk a lot about that later because that's one of the things I highlighted in my Defense News op-ed, is this can't be DoD alone. This is not a problem that just the Department of Defense can solve. And so, you know, there were recommendations, you know, that involved the interagency, and it kind of, unfortunately, sort of petered out, you know, once the report was released and, you know, everybody, you know, started working on implementations and then the administration changed and, you know, everybody went back to their day jobs. And so, you know, I would say that there was some progress, but I would not say that the hopes for, you know, major change that would occur to make it as successful as it could have been.
That's a great point, actually, because when it came out, I started looking at it, and just the name of it, the National Defense Industrial Strategy. If you know anything about the national defense strategies and how those are all nested, you have the National Security Strategy, which is the highest one, mm-hmm. that is whole of government. You have a National Defense Strategy, which nests under that is the Pentagon, the Department of Defense. And then you have a National Military Strategy, which is the military part of the Department of Defense. And so when this came out, if you look at the three tiers of where that nests, it's basically, this is the Pentagon's plan, which, but to your point, Chris, like, this is supposed to be a whole government approach. Why is it coming from the Pentagon and not from the executive branch level as a national security industrial strategy?
There is a recognition that there needs to be more than just the Department of Defense focused on that. The White House has, has a new council on supply chain resilience. It's being co-chaired by the National Security Advisor and the National Economic Advisor, and includes the heads of the departments and agencies and other offices that have come together to help solve supply chain issues, not just for DOD, but for a nation as a whole. So I think that, you know, there is a recognition that this is not just defense. And certainly, some of this administration's key pieces of legislation, the infrastructure, the IRA and the CHIPS Act and things like that are focused on not just DOD, but infrastructure and industry outside of DOD. So there definitely is a recognition that it's not just defense, but certainly defense is at the forefront when we look at what's happening in Ukraine and with Russia deciding it's going to invade countries just because it feels like it. And, you know, with China rattling in the Taiwan Straits and what that could possibly mean, there seems to be a lot more recognition that this is becoming a more urgent problem than perhaps it had been in most recent history.
That's actually a good point. When you look at, like, deterrence, I think the tweet level summary is that production is deterrence.
Exactly. A healthy industrial base is a deterrent. If our adversaries know we have the capability to produce what we need to defeat them, they are going to be less likely to take that kind of role. They'll be more likely to either not do anything at all or at least negotiate, right?
Yeah, and the NDIS, for those who haven't read it yet, we'll have a link in the show notes. It has four basically pillars. Resilient supply chains is the first one, workforce readiness, flexible acquisition, and then finally economic deterrence. And we're going to spend probably most of the time on the first one because that's just a wicked problem by itself. But as Chris said before, it's about not just the parts, but the peoples and the processes. And so the strategy tries to kind of encapsulate all of it. But the supply chains is fascinating to me because you can issue a document or executive order, but that's not actually going to fix anything, especially not the supply chains, because there's just so many economic incentives and complexities. And you nailed it earlier, I think, where you said, you know, if there's no incentive to stay, you're going to offshore. And that's, you know, capitalism 101. What's the most economic way I can solve someone's problem? And then you optimize for that. And so when I think of the resilient, that word resilient, you can either, optimize for resiliency, which means redundancy, or you can optimize for efficiency. And mm-hmm. I would propose that probably the last few decades, for a variety of reasons, the supply chains across the United States are all optimized for efficiency. And so they have zero resiliency.
Yeah. Exactly.
Or excess capacity.
Or excess capacity, right? So responsiveness and resiliency. Resilient isn't, it's part of the problem, but not all of it. Yeah, you're exactly right. So I guess my question is, how do you execute a strategy to rebuild that resiliency and responsiveness without dump trucks of money to incentivize having multiple suppliers of multiple things and having, and building up stockpiles that they're not going to be ready to sell or investing in machinery? And then how do you protect that year after year, all this quote government waste from Congress?
One of the main challenges, and the NDIS does mention this as one of the challenges, I believe the largest barrier to executing the NDIS and to really make our supply chains more resilient is funding. Although the defense budget seems large, it's $800 billion, and that's a lot of money. The fact is that the defense budget used to be 6% of the GDP, and it's now 3%. So that's a huge you know, that's a huge change. And our defense systems are more complex, and so they cost more. And that means the money doesn't go as far. Investments in the industrial base, both in the commercial industry and government-owned facilities, have suffered because of this. If you go into the defense industrial base, and especially the government-owned facilities, there are many facilities that haven't been upgraded since World War II. It's shocking. And the financial instability caused by chronic continuing resolutions and the lack of an annual budget doesn't help any of this. You can't have a healthy and resilient industrial base with this kind of model. The defense industrial base has undergone decades of neglect, and it won't be able to turn itself around overnight. You know, it's going to take investment. It's going to take everybody working together. It's going to take the realization, which is, you know, one of the main points of my op-ed, is I don't really think people get that this is a crisis. And, you know, we really need to have everybody working together and understand that and do whatever it needs to take to, you know, solve this problem. And that means investing in, you know, capacity and maintaining that capacity. Yes, sometimes it's going to sit there and we're not going to use it. But you know what? When we need it, we need it. And we can't reconstitute it quickly enough. Before I left the department about 6 months ago, I led the effort for Undersecretary LaPlante to scale up production of all the weapon systems we were sending to Ukraine. So I live this every day, and we cannot surge production. We cannot. We do not have the capability to do that at the prime level or the sub-tier suppliers. And so we need to be able to have a different model where we do have some production capability that's sitting there waiting in case we have these situations, because if we don't, it's going to take, you know, a year or two to fund it and get it started. And then it's going to take another year or two to actually start making things. So now we're 4 years down the road. And, you know, if we're in a crisis, we don't have that kind of time.
Yeah. When you said weapons, I dealt with some of that when I worked in the Pentagon. And we were looking at, this is before Ukraine, obviously. We were looking at where production lines capacities are, where you can increase them. And some of the, like, hey, we want to buy this many munitions. This goes back to like multi-year procurement. So stability of demand. And there's a whole bunch of things that policy, you know, you get what you incentivize, right? So if you only fund things on a one-year basis, there's no incentive to invest in capacity expansion initiatives. You know, when we talk about expanding supply chains for like munitions, I don't think most people realize like what that means is they just hire a third shift of people mostly. And then they ask all their sub-suppliers to surge. I remember one weapon guidance kit, not the weapon system, the guidance kit. The guidance kit cost about $25,000. It had 75 suppliers. They had optimized so much for like just-in-time delivery for manufacturing, just like you see at like a Walmart, like stocking Walmart. And you have to go ask all 75 companies that are supporting you that you're depending on to all coordinate and orchestrate their surge. It sounds so simple, but it is a wicked, wicked problem. And the 1 year, a little bit of the budget stability with you know, continuing resolutions, like you said, but just the lack of like multi-year procurement commitments from like year after year that would do that. And then obviously there's a ton of other incentives. You can get creative, but yeah, I always thought it was fascinating of like, how are we supposed to do this? And I realize like there's not a really good example of it, I guess, happening in history with the United States, at least like in World War II, like the arsenal democracy didn't just happen overnight. I think we had like 2 years of crisis execution to build that up, to be able to do, you know, what we did in World War II.
We were in a very different starting point. We were a manufacturing economy.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a matter of changing what we were building a little bit. It wasn't a matter of starting from scratch. And we're more in the from scratch. We were also coming out of an era where women weren't in the workforce, right? So we had a ready workforce that we could recruit and train and put into manufacturing that doesn't necessarily exist today, right? We have a much lower unemployment rate.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why that whole arsenal democracy argument drives me crazy. because
please,
you know, everybody's
we're a big fan of spicy takes. We'd love to hear some, Chris.
It's like, you know, everybody's like, read Freedom's Forge. Why can't we do that, you know, again? And I'm like,
Arthur Herman, cover your ears.
Oh, don't I have it. I have it right here. Freedom's Forge.
No, I love that book. It's an amazing book. I did when I was in the department. I still do some lectures at the Eisenhower School, you know, at the National Defense University. And I did one at the end of the year every year on mobilization to the entire school. And one of my slides was always, why not Freedom's Forge? Because everybody thinks, well, we can just do this, you know, again, why can't we do this? And you mentioned a couple of things, and people don't realize that effort started years, two or three years before the war even started. So we were already mobilizing. Number two, we just came out of the Depression, and there was all kinds of factories just sitting around idle with nothing to do. And so they were very happy to switch over from making cars to making airplanes and tanks. They were desperate for work, so they were ready to do that. Again, you mentioned the workforce, especially the women, you know, Rosie the Riveter, right? The famous, example. Our systems are so much more complex these days. We don't need Rosie the Riveter. We need Rosie the gyroscope technician. And those, you just don't have those people walking around, right? So there's just a lot of reasons why in contracting, you know, I mean, if you read the book, you know, they just had a handshake and then industry just went off and started building stuff. That's not the way it works. You know, with Ukraine, we tried to get industry to start making stuff and they were like, we're not doing anything until you have a contract.
Yeah, I think the P-51 was a handshake and they started designing it and they were like almost done with it when they finally got a contract. There was something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, nowadays we, you know, until they have a signed contract or at least a UCA, they don't do anything. So, it's a very different situation now. And so, you know, we're doing what we can now with the situation we have, but it's not the same. But yeah, I've been doing this kind of scaling up production for these crises since 2017. So I've been working this for a long time and we have been begging Congress for multi-year procurement authority and advanced procuring long lead time items, because those are two key pieces of authorities that would help the situation massively. And, you know, luckily in 2023 NDAA, they did give authorization for multi-year procurement for certain systems. No appropriations, but authorization, so I'll take it.
It's a start. That means that you're allowed to, but we're not going to give you any money.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but you can spend your own
that
budget
means
on
next
it.
Year, and you get a small appropriation.
Yeah. You know, so the services can use their existing budget to do that. And they are. The Army has a couple of systems and the Navy does too. So good for them. But that's massive, because that incentivizes industry. It gives them the demand signal, the steady demand signal they need to make the investments to have that capability and modernize some of their, you know, processes and equipment. And then advanced procuring long lead time items. You know, Congress is always like, no, early to need. But having those critical components on the shelf when you're getting ready to surge is key. And so in the FY24 NDAA, they're also providing authorization for some advanced procurement of long lead time items. So I'm really, you know, excited by the fact we're making some headway, but, you know, if we can't pass a budget, then, you know, we still have problems.
Being on many different factories across the Department of Defense, the most recent one, as is probably now, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe a year ago. About a year ago now. Wow. I was actually at the F-35 plant in Texas, and great guys, Lockheed Martin, took me around, went up and down the line, did the whole tour, was there all day, and, you know, asked a bunch of questions, and I wrote about some of it can't write about. And we're talking, and I started, well, how many planes are here in this? And it's a mile long assembly line. If you guys haven't seen the pictures, it's fascinating. It's amazing. Modern marvel of engineering of how they put that thing together. And like, yeah, there's like 180, something like that, jets at various stages of assembly in the line. I'm like, well, how long does it take to put one of these things together? Like, well, it's like eight to 10 months, depending. And then to your point, I'm like, well, how long does it take to get all the parts? And like, well, you know, like, those long lead items that take like two and a half years.
Exactly.
So you have to like strategize to order those long lead items so they arrive, and they're all, it's this orchestration. They all have to arrive on time at the right phase of development of the aircraft. And it's such a, it's a house of cards on, you know, if, you know, there's a snowstorm and it disrupts shipping on one key interstate for a week. Well, then that one jet is going to sit there because there's not like a stockpile of engines sitting on the shelf. You know, hey, we got 50 extra engines sitting here because someone's paying for that engine and it's sitting there not being used, which means that no one's making any money off it.
And now tell them to make twice as many.
Yeah.
When Chris Moran was on, I think he said they had, what, somewhere between 25 and 30,000 suppliers, Lockheed Martin does.
Yeah.
And that's not counting how many suppliers their suppliers have. I'm sure some of them are not. They are also buying their parts, right? It's pretty insane web of...
Yeah, I think the F-35 when I was there, I think they were telling me they had 500 tier one. No, that can't be right. They had 500 suppliers. I don't know if that was all tier one or if that was like tier one and tier two.
There's many, many tiers underneath that. So multiply, you know, geometrically.
It's the iceberg. It's the things that's under the waterline that you got to worry about. Because the one, I think there was a few years ago where it was like they did some kind of a supply chain analysis for like submarines or it was a submarine or a ship. And there was only one company left in existence that made like the propeller. And like, well, what happens if the guy just like retires and closes his business? He's not obligated like by law to stay in business. Like, what if he just hangs it up and he goes, ah, I'm just gonna sell it off and retire and, you know, go buy a condo on the beach?
There's an office in the Defense Logistics Agency that has a list of parts that don't have suppliers anymore, and you can go in there and try and work with them to reverse engineer the part. And we've come across a few folks who are trying to do some of that work. But, you know, it's not profitable for the average business to try and reverse engineer some B-52 bolt or something from, you know, 1970.
Now, see, why you got to ruin this? Because, you know, I didn't want to do this on camera, but, you know, I may be starting a defense supply business. I think it's going to be the next cool thing in the next, like, 5 or 10 years.
Am I giving away your story? Sorry, I just stole your thunder.
You're giving away the secret,
however,
man.
However, it's not that easy because then it still needs to be tested and qualified, and there's no money for that, so.
It's like the difference between a 5-cent washer and a $5 washer is paperwork.
If you want a perfect example, you know, when we were scaling it up again for Ukraine, one of the main constraints we ran into, believe it or not, was precision ball bearings. So these aren't the ball bearings you just go to the hardware store and buy. These are exquisitely machined ball bearings that are used in guidance systems for missiles. And there is one qualified supplier in the United States, and they had a backlog of 140 DoD orders. And they obviously were capacity constrained, but they also were operating with antiquated equipment. And so, you know, these lower tier suppliers, unfortunately, operate at very low profit margins, and they don't have enough money to be able to upgrade their facilities and their procedures and their processes. And so, you know, luckily, Congress had appropriated some Ukraine supplemental funding into the DPA Title III account, and we were able to award them $13.8 million to expand their production capacity and modernize their facility so that they could help mitigate this issue. But my point there is that I think industry at the higher tier levels needs to work with their sub-tier vendors to help them, you know, because they are operating at such low profit margins, to, you know, maybe pull together. If there's 140 DoD orders, this is a lot of companies that are ordering from them. If all of them pulled together and helped them invest to upgrade their equipment or allow them to have slightly higher profit margins, then these constraints wouldn't exist. And this is to benefit both that company and these companies that are buying from them. So this is a problem we see over and over again at the lowest tier suppliers.
So if you're a tier four or tier five, one of the lower tier suppliers, I would imagine that your profit margin is like 5-8%, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. They, you know, make very, very low profit margins. And so their innovation doesn't exist there because they can't afford it.
It's bad enough to get new entrants into the market and defense as a tier one supplier when the margins are, you know, not the same as they are in the commercial sector. Traditionally, call it 12% margins plus or minus for a tier one supplier. But now you're looking at, you know, this industrial based strategy. Hey, I need these tier four, tier five suppliers to come in and just love this 5-8% margin. Like, how How do you incentivize that without having, and you could argue weapon systems, a lot of weapon systems, you look at it and you go, how does this cost that much money? I don't understand how this thing costs $1 million. And I guess the price adds up quickly, obviously, but what incentives exist to solve that problem? It just seems like an unsolvable problem.
It's not as lucrative as commercial industry. I mean, so these suppliers have to want to be in the defense business. A lot of them are patriots, and they want to be in the defense business for that reason, because it's not as lucrative a business as commercial. And the lower and down in the supply chain you are, the lower profit margins you typically make. So it is difficult sometimes, but you know, if you get enough of these programs, you can make a decent profit. But yeah, it's a struggle sometimes.
So Jake's an investor, and Jake, I'd like you to weigh in here. So from the investor point of view, I know you're a venture capital guy, but even from like private equity, when you look at like, hey, the tier four, tier five supply base is basically antiquated. It needs to be modernized. It needs new life, and it needs resiliency. So it needs more entrants. How does the capital markets navigate that? We're like, well, we need all of this, but we can't give you any money because we're not going to get any money back from this.
It's hard to invest in a business with 5 or 10% margins so that they can increase their production capacity, right? Because you have to pay back your capital investment somehow. And if it's 5% margin, it's going to take a very long time to do it. Part of the answer maybe goes back to multi-year buys. So if you tell me I need to surge my capacity this year and double my production, all right, so I've got to go out and build a new factory. But that's a one-year order because we're shipping stuff to Ukraine this year, but maybe not yet next year. So I'm going to have to amortize the cost of my factory over a year, right? 1 year instead of a 30-year amortization schedule, which is what I might do if my factory is producing stuff for Boeing, the commercial side of the house. So either I'm going to do it because I'm a patriot and I'm going to lose my shirt on it, or I'm going to pass the costs, all the costs through to the government, and you're going to have to pay 10x what you should for my parts, because you're going to have to pay for the fact that I just had to build a new factory, right? In the 1 year where I have a contract. It's just not tractable. So changes need to happen.
And Chris, you probably saw some examples of that when you're looking at this, right?
Yeah, and we do get a lot of some of the small businesses, you know, are some of those folks at the lower tier suppliers where they're just starting out, they're, you know, smaller companies. And so they're not looking for those larger profit margins like some of the other companies. So that's where we do have suppliers that do have innovation and do have modernized business practices, et cetera. So one of the areas, for instance, where we've seen a lot of activity recently is in solid rocket motors. I mentioned that before. That became a major constraint as we were scaling up missile production. And there's been a long history where there's only been two solid rocket motor providers, major solid rocket motor providers in the United States, and they are severely capacity constrained at the moment. And so the department has been looking to expand solid rocket motor production, you know, the pool of folks that make solid rocket motors for quite some time. And there's almost a dozen companies right now that are looking to be the new solid rocket motor provider. And they're bringing, you know, some innovative technology with them because the current suppliers are using technologies, although perfectly fine, would not be considered innovative. So it's really refreshing. These people are bringing in some new blood to the sector. You know, it's really kind of spurred some innovation in this area. So that's a perfect example of, you know, that's a lower tier supplier. It's not going to be a 12% profit margin, but there's quite a big interest in this, and there is demand there. And so they are seeing the opportunity to be able to enter into this sector. And we're really, the department was really encouraged by that. I led kind of that effort right before he left as well.
The solid rocket motor industry, it's actually a topic I had planned on doing an episode on in the near future. I saw the same thing. There's two incumbents. They've been there forever. They're basically the result of over consolidation of that industry over the past, you know, 20 years or so. One of them got bought by Northrop. The other one got in a lawsuit over another acquisition because it was the last independent solid rocket motor producer in the United States. And it was going to, the primes were all fighting over it of who should own it or no one should own it. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like over like the next 18 months, like five or six new companies just jumped into the market. Some of them I maybe just a little bit late. But I think the thing was there was a clear demand signal that that was a critical pain point in industry, but it also had an asymmetric upside because the energetics was just ripe for disruption with 3D printed materials. And there's some of the entrants are 3D printed rocket motors. They're able to do it faster and cheaper. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives them that advantage to enter that market where they can maintain the same price potentially and have a bigger margin because it's costing them a lot less.
Exactly. Yeah. I was leading that whole effort for the undersecretary, reviewing all those new entrants, and I led all the mergers and acquisitions stuff too. So yeah, that's definitely my area of expertise as well.
Which one's your favorite? Well, we can beep it out. Just tell me.
Firehawk, right? Like Will Edwards, great guy, great company. Not a portfolio.
All right. We've been talking a lot of bad stuff and a lot of doom and gloom. So Chris, let's have some good stuff. What does success look like for a implemented, executed national defense industrial strategy? What does that look like?
Success is going to start when everyone agrees that this is a priority and works together to do everything they can to, you know, make our industrial base what it needs to be for national security. And that means everybody. If one part of this, you know, puzzle is missing, then the puzzle is not going to be complete, right? We need the executive branch. We need the legislative branch. We need industry. We need allies and partners. So I talked about the White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience. That's a great start from one part of the executive branch. DOD definitely needs to be a big part of this. The Industrial-Based Policy Office, I talked about earlier, has been doing a great job identifying issues and making investments to improve industrial-based health for quite some time. But the acquisition community really needs to also work on making sure they consider industrial-based health as part of their decision space when they make budget decisions. And this is identified in the NDIS too, you know, as acquisition decision space.
Does that mean there's going to be maybe there's a world where there's like a check on a block when you apply for something, like you're a small disadvantaged, you know, business, like those criteria where like, hey, you've been identified as a sector that's at risk?
Yeah, no, it's more like things like incentivizing domestic or allied sourcing through contract selection criteria. You know, right now, the way programs contract with the prime, right? They don't contract with sub-tier suppliers. So they, F-35 contracts with Lockheed to make an F-35. And then Lockheed goes out and finds all the sub-tier suppliers to supply all the components and parts and materials they need. The department doesn't dictate to the prime who they have to use. They can, but they don't because they don't want to have the liability if one of those parts or components and materials doesn't work for some reason. They don't want to have that liability. They want the contractor to have liability.
Do you remember the magnet?
Yes.
Jake, do you know about the magnet?
I don't. I want to hear about the magnet.
Oh, Chris, I'll let you tell the story. Tell the story about the magnet.
Well, I mean, so, you know, the department is not allowed to buy rare earth magnets from that originate in China, right? So, you know, that is so far down on the supply chain, and the department struggles, and so does industry struggle with supply chain visibility, right? A lot of the times the department and industry do not know where some of these things come from, that, you know, it turns out that some magnets in the F-35 came from China. So that became a big problem, obviously, because that's not allowed.
What I remember, it was like the, you know, Lockheed's a tier one, the tier two, I think it was the APU. It was a subcomponent and mm-hmm. of the tier two. And then the tier two, the piece of the tier two was from a tier three. And then the tier three sourced it from a tier four. And then the tier four bought the raw, like, magnetic material from someone who then bought it from China. So it was like way down.
Exactly. And so the problem is that, you know, DoD contracts are the prime. And so they have direct contract, what's called privity. They have contract privity with the prime. Then the prime had contracts with the first tier suppliers. So they have contract privity with those folks. Then the first tiers contract with the second tiers. The primes don't have contract privity with those second tiers because they don't contract with them directly. So they don't actually see, you know, see them unless the first tiers let them. And yep. DoD doesn't see them unless they let them, right? So pretty soon you lose all visibility down into the supply chain. So that's a chronic issue, and that's something that the department has been working on for quite some time now and is outlined in the NDIS is greater visibility into the supply chain. But this happens all the time. I mean, there's probably other systems that this is the case for. So
we used to buy all of our titanium from the Soviets, right? Although we did it without them necessarily knowing and through shell corporations, and it was very intentional. But
I mean, it made for a great story, you know, a couple decades later. We have the shell company to buy the titanium to build the spy plane to fly back over and spy on you. Yeah.
Right. But the problem is the incentive is to go for the cheapest material, right? And where's the cheapest material coming from? Adversarial sources most of the time, right? And, you know, DoD sometimes incentivizes that behavior because given two equally technically acceptable proposals, they're going for best value, right? And sometimes that means the cheapest. So, you know, if DoD would incentivize domestic or allied sourcing through selection criteria, saying giving an extra incentive in your source selection if you use a domestic or allied source versus some other source, that would be a way to avoid that. You're not telling them they have to use a particular source, but you're saying you get extra credit on your proposal if you use a domestic or allied source, right? So that's one thing.
All of those things impose costs though, right?
Sure.
Like we have an entrepreneur working with us right now and he's tinkering and building something and he needs to use brushless motors, most of which are made in China. There are some domestic suppliers, but the cost differential is like 10x for a Chinese brushless motor to an American. Let's take that and blow that out across the system. If we're going to rely on Build American and we're going to pay for it, where does the extra money come from? Right, like you said, I'm a big proponent. We could have larger defense budgets, right? We're at 3% of GDP today. During the Cold War, it went as high as 9, but certainly, you know, 6% historically odd. But coming out of World War II, our debt as a percentage of GDP was very similar to what it is today when we are not currently in a world war, theoretically. So how do we pay for these costs today? Or what are the trade-offs? Like, and I think the answer is there probably have to be trade-offs.
Yeah, I mean, we have, what, a $1 trillion deficit or something every year? Like, you could zero the defense budget for a year and it still wouldn't balance the budget.
Yeah, so cost is monetary and it's also risk, right? So, yes, it costs more.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're buying your magnet from China. Guess what happens if China invades Taiwan? Guess what you're not getting from China? Magnets, okay? So now you have no source of your magnets from China.
Oh, no, you're preaching the choir. I understand it. I agree with you. I just don't see the appetite. Again, until there's a, you know, some kind of like glaring catastrophic failure of the supply chain, like, hey, we just have this new class of nuclear subs. Like, it's a shame we can't move because we don't have a propeller. Like, what do you mean we don't have a propeller? And, you know, those, like, something just comically tragic has to happen to then people, like, actually go, oh, let's wake up.
I know.
And one of the things, I don't think ever, I might be the first person in the world to try to do this, but kind of like nuclear weapons, right? Like, there is a deterrence of just having them if you're not using them, right? So you've built these things and they're there, and just because they're not being used does not mean that there's not a deterrent factor. So having like stockpiles, we do it for WRM a little bit, but stockpiles and fat in the supply chain, if you will, I think there's, I want to say there's probably an opportunity there.
You know, you're right. I mean, COVID-19 did raise some awareness of the fragility of supply chains. You know, the general public just really had no understanding of fragility of supply chains until COVID. I like to say that they didn't understand supply chains until they couldn't get a car or get their car fixed, right? Because of the
toilet paper. Yep.
Well, toilet paper was actually a completely different story. That wasn't a supply chain problem, believe it or not. Or baby formula, right? I mean, they didn't understand. So it actually hit them personally. And quite frankly, that's actually what it's going to take, because the general public just kind of doesn't get it. And I get it. It's not pejorative. It's just, they don't, it's not part of their daily lexicon. They don't talk about this like we do in the defense world, you know?
Yeah.
So until it affects them personally, it's not going to really resonate, and they're not going to want to do something about it. So it is going to take a crisis, unfortunately, but then it's too late. It's too late.
Let's play a game real quick. Let's do bad news, good news. Okay. Chris, you're a very smart woman, been around the block. You know a thing or two about all this. If you had a crystal ball and it was going to predict where you think that this thing is going to manifest first for that awareness that we're talking about, where do you think it's going to happen?
In the public or?
Yeah, where something in the supply chain happens and it becomes just like glaring, obvious thing that the American public realizes it finally. Congress is like, oh my God, what happened? What do you think it's going to be?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I mean, China has already been systematically eliminating exports of critical items. I'm sure you guys have been following gallium, germanium, graphite. You know, they just keep checking the boxes. So, you know, graphite is a key component in batteries that go in electric vehicles. So it's just a matter of time, because they have a giant list of things and they know where our pain points are. And so it's just a matter of time until, you know, gallium and germanium are subcomponents of microelectronics. So, you know, you're again way down on the supply chain. I think it's only a matter of time where you get to one of those components that actually is closer to a commercial thing that the public cares about. And I can't predict which one of those things it is, but there's many, many of them. You know, I used to show what I called the scary slide to Congress when I briefed them about all the things that DOD relied on that we had sole sourced from China, like ammunition, you know, a lot of the components of a lot of the ammunition that we buy and make, you know, come from China. I think China is going to systematically go down that list and keep tightening the noose until it's going to get to the point where the American public is going to be directly affected.
It's a weird dynamic if you think about it. Even with allies, every ally I think is starting to realize that their industrial base is critical to their own, like, sovereign, you know, economy, national security, and so not being overly dependent on other things. You've probably seen a knee jerk from, like, the fighter jet capacity. Like, there's, I don't know, four, five, six generation programs now, where everyone's like, hey, we didn't build an aircraft for 40 years. We, you know, relied on the United States. Well, now we don't have an industry. Mm-hmm. So part of, like, rebuilding the industry is, like, they have to build something. And that's a part of, like, restoring their sovereign economy and deterrence. So unlike a commercial market where we have a global connected economy, it almost seems like a weird conundrum to be in, where all of the defense industrial bases are by nature trying not to be globally connected to a point, right? There's obviously co-productions, licenses and stuff, like bilateral agreements here and there, but they're, like, purposely not integrated, right?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, people think that to a certain extent about the U.S., but the U.S. has never had and will never have a completely domestic industrial base. We've always depended on partners and allies. We've never had a completely domestic industrial base. We can't. I mean, there's multiple reasons. You know, we don't have enough demand to sustain capacity for a lot of the items that we need. So we have to rely on aggregating demand with partners and allies. We don't have the best innovation sometimes. We need, you know, some partners and allies, technology sometimes. So there's
multiple. What do you mean? America's supposed to be the best.
I said sometimes.
Breaking news. We might not be the best at everything all the time, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we have to rely on partners and allies, and we should. I mean, we're all in this together. And so there needs to be co-production, co-development. Dr. Plan talks about that a lot. But really, there needs to be, you know, a lot of effort where there's components and parts and materials that we kind of share supply bases with as well, because that's where a lot of the constraints lie. Co-development and co-production is good. That's the big bright shiny object that we were aiming for, but it's really those constraints in the supply base where we don't have enough demand. We need to leverage partners and allies where we should be aiming.
Okay, so we talked about bad news. I want to end this on a good note, okay? So instead of the crystal ball of badness, I'm going to give you a magic wand.
Love it.
Love the magic wand. All right, Chris, you have a magic wand, but you can only wave it and fix one thing. What is the one thing that you would fix with your magic wand and your one wish?
Okay. Wow, you have to think carefully here. One wish.
One, just one.
And it can't be Congress. Congress, like saying you're going to fix Congress is like wishing for more wishes. It's got to be something else.
And it can't be a bajillion dollars, right? So then you can just hand it out. Like, can't be that.
All right. Okay, man, you took away my first two wishes. So, all right, we're going to rely on my third wish and keep harping on it. And I think that the sense of the urgency, you know, that everyone suddenly woke up tomorrow and had the same sense of urgency that I feel and a lot of the people in the department feel, a lot of people in the White House feel, a lot of people in Congress feel, and in the interagency feel, that everyone felt that, so that we wouldn't constantly be battling each other over whether this is important or not. That shouldn't even be a question, right? This is important. And so if I could just, you know, wake up tomorrow and everybody went, oh yeah, this is important, let's just go get it done, instead of just stumbling over each other, that would just make me so happy, because then we could just go do it, you know, instead of just figuring out how to convince each other that it's important.
Wow, that was I wasn't expecting that. That was a fantastic response. If you just magic wand, everyone suddenly cared so much that it's like their number one thing that keeps them up at night. Wow. It's like the boogeyman.
Nobody gets any sleep until it's important.
All right, last question, and I'll leave it for you for final thoughts, Chris. So, as this plan, there'll be an action plan. There's an unclassified one that it's either out now, it'll be out very soon, and then there's a classified one that we won't see for obvious reasons. It'll highlight all the vulnerabilities and tell China where to go look. What are some things, if Congress is going to ask you, like, hey, we have oversight of the Pentagon, they have this action plan, what are the metrics of success that we should be asking the Pentagon to make sure that we're on track?
I've thought about a lot about that, because, you know, metrics are hard sometimes, and a lot of it comes back to the lack of visibility I talked about before. So if you don't really have visibility into some of the things like, you know, how many sole source suppliers does DoD have? We don't know. How many single points of failure?
We don't know?
No.
We'll bleep that out. China, don't listen.
I'm sure it's in the audit somewhere, right?
Exactly. So, you know, so that makes it harder. But there are some metrics that we can trace. We're ally shoring or onshoring capabilities. You know, the Defense Production Act, I talked about that earlier. They're awarding grants. They just awarded one to produce 22 critical defense chemicals in the United States. So we can track that. How many, you know, things have we onshored or, you know, gotten allied sources for? You know, workforce, that's something that's tracked constantly. Industry tracks that, the department tracks that. So certainly we can track strides in that. And that is, again, one of the key constraints for industrial-based health. So I think that's really a key metric. Small businesses doing work for the DoD. The total number of small businesses in the defense industrial base has declined over the last decade. So that's certainly something that we can track.
Yeah, I think the number is 40%. Jumps out at me.
Yeah.
It is substantial, the amount of small businesses that have left in the past 20 or 30 years.
New entrants to a sector, like I talked about solid rocket motors earlier. You know, if we get a lot of new entrants in a sector, that's a great thing. Decrease in foreign ownership and control, you know, if we're able to somehow combat that with our defense industrial base suppliers. And we do track that through the CFIUS process, et cetera. So we do have some metrics that we can track not as extensive of a set that I would like if we had the visibility we have, but there are certainly metrics that we can track. And I think those are going to be good ways that we can really say that we have made an impact with this industrial-based strategy.
The data logging and oversight that exists, whether it's manual or not, there's some opportunity there for data scraping and doing predictive supply chain analytics with AI tools. Mm-hmm. There's something there. I don't know. I'll add it to my my list of good idea fairies businesses.
Another business for you.
Yeah. When you're done with the parts business,
you can add it to the pile over here.
Yeah. I'm feeling both better and worse than I was before the call. So that's a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, I you know what? I was thinking the same thing. I'm not sure how I feel. I feel like there should be a sense of urgency. That's what I feel like. That's Chris's magic wand. So Chris, any final thoughts? And where can people learn more about the work you're doing for supply chains and defense technology?
Yeah, I retired from the Department of Defense about 6 months ago. I have my own consulting company, MMR Defense Solutions. So I'm on LinkedIn. So please just look up my name on LinkedIn and you'll find me. And I'm very happy to talk to people about supply chains and all kinds of things in Department of Defense. My only agenda has always been helping the warfighter, and that's what I really want to continue doing. So I appreciate your time today. It's been really great discussion.
Thanks, Chris. And we'll put a link to your consulting company in the show notes, and we'll put your LinkedIn bio in the show notes so people can reach out to you. Thanks again for your time. I really do appreciate it. Again, I'm not sure how I feel. A little happy, a little sad.
Well, I'm sorry, and thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris.
I'm hopeful. All right, well, that's it. That's the show. Leave us a review and a rating, and until next time, we'll see you.